The host has arrived.
Are we on mute?
Not anymore.
There's according to the clock on the wall, 9:05, so we'll come back in session for September 15th. Real quick, I've got an announcement to make regarding the live streaming. Starting at 1 p.m. today, the board meeting will be live streamed through the State of Alaska's WebEx webinar service. The live stream link can be found on the LIO's right now webpage at akl.tv, that's akl.tv, and on the department's homepage in the state board meeting news release at education.alaska.gov. Members who wish to call in and listen to the toll-free number is 1-855-244-8681. That's 1-855-244-8681. Meeting access code is 807-900-742. 807-900-742. Okay.
Okay,
that does that announcement, and I just need a motion for today's agenda.
I move to adopt the agenda for September 15th, 2017.
This is Member Harmon. I second that motion. Okay, it's been moved and seconded. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, roll call.
Member Gallahorn is absent. Dr. Hamilton?
Yes.
Second Vice Chair Harmon?
Yes.
Member Hemshoot?
Yes.
First Vice Chair Hall?
Yes.
Member Michael?
Yes.
Member Thompson?
Yes.
Colonel Van Meter?
Yes.
Chair Fields?
Yes. Does anyone wish to change his or her vote at this time? Seeing no changes?
Mr. Chair, the motion passes to adopt the agenda for September 15th.
Okay, thank you. The first item is board self-evaluation. And this, if we've had a chance to look at it, I think this is just a template that came from NASB. We talked about the process when we met with them, in June, I think. One of those meetings. And so this right now is just an opportunity for me to take this general template. We're not necessarily filling it out right now. It's just I wanted to give you something to look at as a starting point. So over the next month and a half, if it's something you can kind of look at and massage what you think is in there, what you think doesn't need to be in there, this is just a starting point so you can start going to the process of getting ourselves an evaluation tool for this board, and this time make comments or suggestions. Member
Hinshu. So is this a tool that we would fill out individually on our own and then discuss, or what's your vision for somebody who would before a meeting, then come together and somebody would aggregate?
Right, yeah, so we would do it individually, and it would go to someone that they, yeah, put down, the comments put down maybe the average score for, and we talk about it as a board.
And are there other examples out there? I liked a lot of what I saw, but is there somewhere else we should be looking for other examples?
We could probably go to NASA and see if there's other state boards. This is more a local, as you can see, it's more of a local type feel. But I would imagine there's other ones we could look at. We could probably just extend it or probably try to track a few of those down more.
Hey, Member Michael.
Hey,
AASB releases a self-evaluation thing for school boards that we could look at if you guys would prefer that too.
That was my comment. This is Member Hall. I contacted AASB in 2017 about six different models, all kinds of other things to look at. It seems to me that we might want to think about a section or something to get the feedback from the board members related to this tool, and then maybe get a little group together to pull that.
Yeah, I'm concerned about adding more to SEMA. I don't like my request.
And in the past, of course, this is on the local, in our district, it's usually come to the, like, when I was board president, I would basically take that information, get it in a list, and then from there you could see obviously which ones are similar, which ones weren't, so you could kind of pull it together, aggregate it.
Were you talking about once we get a tool and more information then comes to you, or when you talk about
it? Even in the process, I think we need to, there may be examples, but we need to have a general template that we're working off of first. And then, for instance, let's take the one that's right here. You can still get AASB and C, but we need a general layout first.
I'm in agreement with Sue that maybe a group of us should find those examples. Anybody can find them, and then propose the items that we think should be on there.
What I would say is let's stick with the template. Let's just stick with this template. Okay. What the questions may be for the information is totally different. If not, we can say, well, two members like this template, three members like this. So I would just try to stick with the template. Then when we get into the questions, how they're written, and if they actually work for the board, that's really what we're getting to. The template. It has to really do with the information. If we're gleaning the information, we really want.
Right, and my in making sure. I just want to see multiple examples of the questions.
Right, exactly. Which again, that's something that any board member can go out and find 7, 8, 9 different evaluations. And say, I like this question. I like this question. And then you can send those questions to me. I can aggregate them and then get them out. Now, there may be a bunch. There may be some that are very similar. And I can group those and say, okay, these are pretty similar. Where are we at? We could do it in a subcommittee. Anybody willing to take on that subcommittee?
If it's necessary, I like the idea of experimenting on research.
I'm fine with that if it becomes overwhelming. I just don't know how in depth you guys are. And if I did like 100 different questions, yes, it would definitely be necessary. but if it looks like it's coming down to, okay, we just have some. So maybe I'll see what it looks like after three weeks. And if it's looking overwhelming, I will contact for it. Member Hamilton.
Just a reminder, every time you do an evaluation, whether it's a board or any other business, what can you send the outcome? And so we can fill out these 90 questions and do all the searching, but it's a lot of work. We for sure know what our intended outcome is. So I would say that the subcommittee is they need to just determine what we want at the end of this. Is this to be a good board member? Is this to be a better effective participant in statewide educational issues? Is it to know that we're making every meeting and smiling when we're here? We have to have an intended outcome here before we go down looking at 50 or 60 different questions, because it can be onerous for the people doing all the work, and at the end you're thinking, we really didn't get what we wanted out of this. So that's my recommendation.
And I would say, for me personally, the intended, and I think that we talked about that, but the intended outcome is that we've got a healthy, functioning board with 9 board members that feel as though they're involved, they're heard, and we're functioning as a board. I think that would be the intended, when you're doing a self-evaluation.
Put that at the top of the list and start finding evaluative tools for that.
If anybody else wants to weigh in with theirs, what they feel, they go ahead and remember.
I like the dimensions that I saw in this particular template, so even that is something we could discuss further as far as if we look at other examples and we see different dimensions that boards are looking at, but I kind of like the idea of doing it occasionally and potentially how are we doing it before. So I thought it was spelled out in this template pretty well, but we should look at it more.
And again, this is our first go, so, you know, you're asking the right questions. I don't expect the answers right now because this is our first go at even looking at when it's starting. So just know this is a process. We're not making any decisions today on the intent member hole.
Just two things. One is it's healthy for us to do this. We just need to, we need to have conversation about how we're doing and what disconnects people and what doesn't, and, you know, kind of look at our performance the same way we look at the performance of the commissioner. Having a second point, I would say, is simply better. Having been part of these kinds of conversations, board self-evaluation kind of conversations for long years, if you get too many questions, you really can't, you can't hone in on what really is at the heart of it. So I think simple is better, and then the conversation is on when we aggregate the comments is the really important part.
Great, thank you. Any other questions, comments right now? Okay, good. We will move on to the next one, which is board processes. And I don't know if the commissioner has a piece of this.
Sure, so this is, as the Anna Holland, Vice Chair Holt speaks to it also, but we had several conversations as we talked about revising the board bylaws about some of the processes and protocols the board should have for itself regarding various things such as travel, when you're invited to speak at various things, taking positions on legislative issues, those sorts of things, because your authority is as a collective group, not as individuals. And so I think having those processes in place is important. School boards around the state have those processes, and I think this board has had them unwritten in the past, but over the last 12 to 18 months, you've had a significant amount of turnover in the administration here at the department, and even to the board members, and so I think this is a great opportunity as you're doing strategic planning to think about your own processes, and so we wanted to put it on the agenda, not for you to figure out those processes today, but to start that conversation. So I know last night three of you talked about bylaws, and this was a little bit about that conversation, so Vice Chair Hall or Member Harmon.
Member Howell, I'll just report on our little subcommittee. Member Hinshute and Second Vice Chair Harmon. We met and went through the bylaws, and we have a proposal for the board to come back at some future time. But as part of that conversation, there are a number of things in our bylaws currently that are really minutiae, if you will. They're very detailed procedures. And when NASBE reviewed our bylaws, they suggested that we consider putting some of those things in standing rules. And the committee last night would like to make that recommendation to the board that we develop standing rules. And it relates to what the commissioner was just talking about, that we could pull the things out of the bylaws that are kind of detailed little processes, but also we could add to the standing rules things that all of us have recognized over the years. You know, when you come onto the board, you're uncertain about what the processes are. It would really help people to know what they do when someone approaches them about speaking or those sorts of things. So I think there's a kind of convergence of needs here that might be remedied by a set of standards.
Yeah, I don't know if the question's necessary, but do we need standing rules and procedures? Because they can be different things, right? Or do we just need standing rules?
This is Member Hall. My response to that would be, let's see. You know, I think it would be wise for us to do that in the subcommittee again, where we can kind of hash things out and then bring it back to the board with a proposal so it doesn't take up everybody's time. But, and you know, if it becomes complicated and we see a clear division between the two, then we need to do that. For right now, I think standing rules would be a good step forward just that.
Member Johnson.
I think I'm asking the same question again in a different way, but right now we have bylaws, but we don't have procedures for
standing
rules. What's the difference between a bylaw and a
Yeah, so Robert's rules have some, you know, criteria, and I can't quote that off the top of my head, but they're it's pretty standard procedure to have bylaws be the big organizing important things that don't change. That's why there's a two-thirds vote required, which in our bylaws, it says that the bylaws can be changed with a simple majority, and that's, you know, that's kind of unheard of. So the bylaws have become a collection of things that traditionally would be part of standing rules that can be changed. Standing rules can be suspended. You know, the Fairbanks Board has a policy that we will end our meetings by 10 o'clock, but sometimes we just move the suspended rules for 15 minutes to go a little longer. So standing rules are a little more flexible, and the board can change them, and the bylaws really should be reserved for those things that are kind of the organizing articles of the group, not just the little processes that might change over time.
We need both.
Yeah, and but the bylaws, a lot of times, the rules may change based on the makeup of the board. So that's where you want to have that flexibility to make those changes quicker than the bylaws.
And I would just add one reason that I think the plan is right to have some of the standing rules that maybe we haven't. The need hasn't been as great in the past because you had folks here at the department that were able to help shepherd the board through those things because they've been here a long time. But to have something that outlives any of us that, you know, no matter how long we're here, either on the board or as staff, so the future boards have that those guidelines. They can change them, like Member Hull said. It provides clarity in terms of our behavior as individuals, but also the bylaws and guidance as a collective body.
Any other questions, comments? So I think it's a great suggestion, and I think timing-wise, it's good because I think we are a more vocal board, and that's great. That's what we want. We want to be able to have you guys out talking different groups, different settings, but we just need to make sure that obviously we're on the same page and these standing rules and processes will help us get there. So I appreciate your openness. It's not a matter of worrying about any of that. It's just to make sure that we don't get ourselves as a board into potential trouble or, you know, any types of opinions or anything that we don't want out there. So thank you for your work you did last night, and we were expecting good things. Is that it?
Okay, we're on to high school testing update.
All right, the board will be briefed on the plans for high school testing in spring 2018. And while Margaret and Margaret McKinnon and Deb Riddle come up to the podium and call pressing, I want to just, I'm very excited about this. Work that we're doing. We've mentioned it to the board before, but we just want to make sure the board kind of knows what we're doing, what our steps are, and is aware, because this would be the shift in our assessment program for the state, and so we don't want to get out ahead of the board. So we want the board to be informed of what we're doing. But I think this is, in terms of impact on student achievement, this has a lot of potential for our state if we do it well. So, call pressing is upon your approval, the director of student learning, the division where this is happening. Deb Riddle is a really important person in that division. She'll tell you her title and it's her turn. And then Margaret is the coordinator of federal programs. And Deb and Margaret have been working really closely as Deb kind of takes over the assessment part of that program. And so they've been working on this. They have some information to share so that you feel like you're up to speed with what we're doing.
Thank you, Commissioner.
I'll jump in here really quick. For the record, this is a follow-up question. I'm part of your approval this afternoon anyway. Yeah, as director for the Division of Student Learning. We've had, as the commissioners mentioned, we've had a little bit of a reorganization here within the department. The deputy director position, which is the position I held for quite a few years, was reclassified as a division's operation manager. right, reviewed the class structure of those two positions. I felt the space and operations managers more closely really reflected the new duties of the organization. Luckily, Ben Riddle has stepped up to the plate, and so I do. Deputy Director of Division Operations Manager, so I'm really excited to have her on board and have kind of these leadership roles filled so we can start actually implementing changes to the organization that the Commissioner would like to see. And in addition to the changes, Margaret McKinnon has kind of shifted from, maybe you used to know Eric McCormick, we used to have Assessment Director of Soli. She's shifting over to federal programs role. And really what this is, I think is critical, is that you know, she was the National Title I Director, President for the National Committee for a couple of years. She's sat on U.S. Department Title II review application group, the waiver application. So she just has a wealth of federal programs knowledge, and with a new grandbaby, I expect her in handy departure here sometime soon after 44 years of state service. 40, it seems like 44. So really over the next year or two or three, whenever we're in the site, she's going to spend more time with the grandchild. We really want to shore up, as the Commissioner is trying to get the turnover and staff, how can we make sure that we have the policies and procedures and build on her federal programs knowledge. So really we have, just as you mentioned about your own board policies, how do we as the division and department can really make sure that we have our policies and procedures in place for federal programs. With that, Deb is going to be, and myself, will be having more of a role with the whole assessment piece. And we also have hired a new administrator. She's not here right now, Anna Uterra, and she is the admin one within the assessment program. So we've kind of, you know, part of the reorganization is kind of a shifting, splitting of duties. So instead of just all responsibility on one person, we have kind of a shared responsibility on three people. So when people like Margaret or myself again leave, there's multiple people that can take up the pieces. So it's an exciting time. But with that, I'll let Margaret and Deb talk out there. Thank you, Paul, for the
reference. This is Margaret McKinnon, Federal Programs Coordinator. And as Paul said, I'm transitioning my role. But over the last 2 years, I have felt it was really well, it's been an interesting and amazing ride in the assessment world, but relied quite a bit on the work that both Deb Reynolds and Angie Galano did. I'm not sure if they're here today, but they, you know, started as our content specialist at ELIN Math and were a significant part of the process, not only rolling out the new standards, but working with our previous assessment vendors in terms of designing the content and reviewing that into that assessment. And so they've both been invaluable as we walk through this process with our new assessment piece, participating in standards and in alignment, achievement level descriptors and the alignment study. So I feel really pleased and confident in Jeff's ability to be the direct supervisor of the assessment and the new work forward. And a math colleague as well. So we're both math. Once the math teacher, always an emphasis. So that goes to our plan for this year. You did approve the regulations at the last meeting to allow us to get only in one grade in high school. And we started collecting stakeholder feedback about high school testing, you know, a year and a half ago, whenever we started this process. And should we still test in two grades, should we test in one, if so, which grade makes sense? And in particular in mathematics, we've had a little challenge over the last couple of years with the dance as well as the trying to find what standard represents ninth grade and 10th grade. And are we actually testing whatever a student is learning in the classroom in that year? In both cases, we've had a mix of standards, which is primarily algebra and geometry, but maybe some other topics. So then working with our test vendors and looking forward, we decided that ninth grade would be the appropriate grade to test in for 2018, ninth grade only. And some of the stakeholder feedback about that was that you capture the kids in their earliest part of their high school career, so you could look at whether they need future remediation. Those students are more likely to continue testing. We saw much less opt-out from ninth grade, and some of them once again in tenth grade are starting to pick out other things, and they of course have, you know, diversified even more. So we are planning this year to do a ninth grade test only for ELA. So we'll essentially be the same test it was last year, with ninth grade English language arts, so pretty well set. But we've begun talking about an end of course option, and in high school, the primary end of course test would be Algebra 1. And even in the early stages of selecting our vendor, I talked to the two other states that had used a vendor, and I asked one of them about their experience with high school testing, end of course testing. And he talked about, and this was before states had adopted the standards, but the cost of working with their stakeholders, their not only the schools, but also the university system to identify what's the content that they were going to test. And they implemented the test probably in 2009, I think. And some states use an end of course test as a graduation requirement. Some states require a percentage of the course grade to be based on the state test. This state didn't require any of that. They encouraged maybe the course and the course test requirements to be included as part of the course grade, but they didn't require it. But what they found is over time, it has the effect of having the content that was delivered in an algebra course more consistent across the states. And students were needing less remediation when they got to college, no matter what they did in the rest of their high school career. And he said they called it right test, right time. So you can administer an end of course test at the time in which that student is ready for it. That might be as early as eighth grade, is just taking an algebra course in eighth grade. Or maybe ninth grade, which is the typical traditional sequence. Or if you're starting and needing some lower level courses, or you're taking a course that's an integrated approach, where you might not hit all the algebra topics in the first year, or maybe the course has been divided and offered over 2 years, districts could tell us this student is ready for this course now, and it will basically cover the algebra topics. And one of the things that was done as part of the preparation for AS was we did have educators come together in both ELA and math. There's over 20 people in math and in ELA as well. And had a workshop in June of 2014 and looked at the standards. And those educators, the last educators, identified the standard that was being a traditional algebra 1 course as well as geometry and algebra 2. And so we've got that work done. And thinking about what to do for this year in ninth grade, decided that if we revised the test, so last year we had a mixture of algebra and geometry. Revised the test to be a ninth grade algebra test this year, all ninth graders have taken. All ninth graders have taken ELA. But then we can use this year to work with stakeholders and get all the logistics worked out and help people understand what an end of course test is. So then we can move to end of course test. So, and in mathematics, I mentioned that you could give the algebra type to an eighth grader who was taking algebra 1, and that would be in lieu of the standard test. So there would need to be an additional test, at least one additional test, to offer high school students who were advanced. So that's pretty much the overview for that process and where we're heading. Are there any questions?
the rule.
Yeah, just, I think I understood what you were saying, but just let me clarify. So for this year, all ninth graders will take the planning essence in Algebra 1 and a course exam as their math component for students. But the following year, that test, the Algebra 1 and course exam, could be offered to, based on stakeholder input and all of that. I get that there's a process, but that Algebra 1 test could be administered to an eighth grader or a tenth grader, depending on right time, right test, kind of stuff if they're ready for that exam. And then there's the potential for, because every student has to have it, a test during high school, there's a potential that if an eighth grader had taken the algebra test in eighth grade, that then they might have another course test for a more advanced math time. Yes, exactly.
Member Hinchu?
This is exciting. I really like how it sounds. What would be a reason that the district would not like this?
Well, and I actually talked to a number of superintendents, not all of them, but as we walked through the possibilities, they were all supportive. There were some questions in terms of the awareness, would a student be ready, and how would we, you know, the details that we have to work out. Because, okay, who's the population that you would consider for your participation? Not quite a simple thing, everybody in the ninth grade. So those are the logistics that we have to work out. But we have really not gotten any negative response to this when we talk about the rationale and various other states.
So then if it's not everybody in the ninth grade, how do we make sure there's progress for everybody in the ninth grade? They need that speech. Like we do end of course.
So the end of course test would be a little bit of a different type of measure. You would want to measure how well does this student know the concept of Algebra 1 before they get out of high school. So there wouldn't necessarily be a state test for every student in ninth grade.
So I guess I must be missing something. So for those students who aren't doing an algebra craft course, so they don't have that end of course assessment, how do we know that student is receiving instruction and putting them forward?
We would not have a direct state test to measure that in ninth grade.
Member Hall. However, every student will take a test in high school.
And
that test.
At some point in their high school career.
But it would not be a generalized test like TEKS is now, but would be more subject specific. Am I getting it?
Yep.
So there could be, at some point in the 4 years or 5 years that you're in high school, you will have an end of course math test.
Yes.
And if that happens to be in your 12th grade year and you haven't made progress in those 4 years, really we want the school and the district to be finding out. That's not our thing. We're not interested in that. But we're more globally wanting to know the students are progressing, not individual students. That would be up to the district and the school.
Yes.
And I would also, Commissioner Johnson, I would also add, we're also looking at as part of a complete assessment package. And so we don't want an assessment program or a system that where we discover a student does not make progress in math in ninth grade. So we're giving an algebra assessment in ninth grade because we feel like our assessment program up to ninth grade would be flagging any students that are not making the progress they need to, not, and so working under the confidence in our assessment program that we're not going to just discover that in ninth grade. And so it's an important question because we do get students that just arrive to us, but they also participate in assessment programs, that sort of thing. So in the back of your question about why wouldn't we do it, you know, I think we always benefit from the admonishment from our educators, our classroom teachers, that we don't want to test too much. I've never heard from them that they don't want to test. They just want to make sure the tests are meaningful. I think moving in ninth grade, particularly from a generalized high school test and the course assessments in high school, is not testing too much, but definitely moving toward more meaningful assessment at that stage of the student's career. And so I think that addresses a little bit of both your questions.
Okay, and just, I guess, I feel like maybe I'm being a little bit dense, but I'm thinking about a kid who falls into cracks because they somehow aren't taking that assessment for 12th grade. And so now we haven't noticed this kid, and so I'm thinking of the individual student who might be reticent to take algebra so later, or for whatever reason doesn't take that test until later. We could miss a kid.
We could. So I understand the scenario you're talking about, but there are so many things that would have gone wrong before that. If we have a system that a student waits till 12th grade to take algebra and nobody knew that, we have a lot of other problems besides that in the course assessment. And so I appreciate the question because I think it's something that as we implement something like this, we need to think about how are we going to make sure that all those other things are happening up to that point, and that we don't. But I don't think it's the end of course assessment's not the solution to all the problems that would have happened for a kid to get that far and not have taken algebra one or assessment. So it's a valuable question and for the entire system.
Member Hulse. I think as well, you know, long ago there were debates about in our district with leading math teachers saying not all kids can do algebra. Okay. But now that we have the standards we have, which are higher than way back then, algebra is the baseline expectation. And so, you know, as the commissioner said, a student may not take it in eighth grade for the early, you know, the kids that do that stuff early, eighth grade, ninth grade, tenth grade, but by tenth grade, kids are pretty much being, you know, with their counselors and all of that, they know they need to get through algebra. Because the standards that we're all focused on include algebraic concepts. And so I think it would be pretty hard for kids to have the required math credits to graduate and not have been in an algebra class.
One last question then. I appreciate that we have our math teachers on this. We have excellent math teachers in the department. So is it a goal to do this with all standards, so also for ELA, or is it more like just looking to see if it can be done and we might do it, or are we committed to doing this? Or when I say committed, is the intent then to try to kind of look at this and see how it goes and then try to do it with other subjects?
Members of Chief of Margaret McKinnon again, but we are on the path to do this. We've gotten pretty positive stakeholder feedback about this so far, and it looks like it would be the right thing to do for our state. And going to your earlier questions, one of our decisions would be at what grade do we expect a student to take the test? We might say we need to take it by 11th grade. And not wait to 12th grade. Those are some things to work out. When is it appropriate? Because it sends a signal that we do expect every student to have a solid algebra concept by the time they reach high school. I think we know that that's not always the case. You know, there would be, at this point, we're not proposing that they are required to pass it with a certain score, but they come in because of the score. And in terms of English language arts, we would also have an English language arts assessment that would be the end of course assessment. We haven't talked a lot about the details of whether that was going to be called ELA 9 or ELA 1 or whatever the content would be. I did have at least one superintendent, one of the rural districts I was speaking with, indicated that he might want to wait to see his students that test for another year or two and not do it in my school. So those would be kinds of things we need to decide.
And this is Mr. Johnson. I'll just add, you know, I've said to the staff, you know, I don't want to tiptoe into this. I think in the course of assessment, will be really good for Alaska systems. We public education system. We've looked into it. So we're going to try it wholeheartedly. Having said that, you know, we're going to proceed carefully. That's why we're just starting with one. You know, the thought is that we will expand to do all the assessments in high school in the course assessments that we need to for ESSA, but then maybe make end of course assessments available for other things like civics education and some other important topics. But we want to work with stakeholders. I know Annie Applegate here from the Council on Disabilities and Special Education from the government. We certainly want folks like that to be engaged in this conversation on how does this work for all of our students across the state. And so, you know, there's a lot of stakeholder work to be done within the course assessments with folks like the council and others in the state. But we're moving down this path where, you know, it's not like we're looking over our shoulders, so to speak. We're looking ahead, looking to our constituents that need to help us with this process. But we think there's potential for it to be, you know, to comply with that stuff, but then provide something for other subjects that, you know, may not be part of it.
Real quick, I think it's the right direction, and maybe I'll let you respond in a second. Is there any data now, based on Member Hensher's concerns, are about how many students aren't through Algebra 1 by, let's just say, 11th grade?
Yeah, so, Mark, this is a little, we don't keep track of the courses that students take through high school. However, with Algebra, do an algebra one test, and you had really a question about how do you know, you have the other questions that you do through similar answers, and the results that come in, you know who took the test. And as we set up business rules about how the data question can go, we'll be able to provide some information on a regular basis to the district so they can keep track of which students have taken the test or who have. And when you talk about English and Arts and Math, the focus, we talked about this with the previous vendor about doing an in-course test, and it's more beneficial than the district has felt because this allows the teachers to know what exactly which standards are going to be taught, because our math standards are not by grade span, they are by all the content. So to narrow that focus down so that the teachers can teach and the children can learn the things that they're going to be assessed on instead of getting items on a test that they haven't seen before. That's one of the reasons that this is really important. ELA is grade span. It's already outlined by grade, so it's a little easier to transition that way. It's not the outline math. It's going to be a little bit more outlined.
And I'll just add to that that Director Williams is doing some, he's working with Brian Loran, our data manager, and looking into some of the questions, like where are certain math courses being taught or being offered even, which schools are offering what math in high school, and so they started looking into that, because there's some important questions that we want to answer across the state.
And the whole of the membrane.
Okay, now I'm really getting a little bit down in the mud, but so a student takes the ending course and has a really atrocious score, maybe something hard with their family, or for some reason they just didn't do well on that test. We don't need them to retest necessarily, and their district could then, their school could decide what their minimum requirement is for passing grade. But is there another end of course test so a student could retake that test, or we wouldn't? Are we doing this for us to get data, or for, is it diagnostic for the teacher? Because if the student did very poorly and wanted to take it again, this is the burden of teachers all the time to come up with another test for a kid to retake a test.
So, Member Hinship, Margaret McKinnon, this is one of the questions that we would work out. Would there be options for retake? Because it isn't designed to be a high-stakes test that you have to pass, the students wouldn't necessarily need to retake it. whether there's an option to retake it or not is a good question. I mean, if schools want to use that information as part of the course grade or to incentivize that student,
if that for me is okay, so we did what we need to know, but that doesn't really help that kid. So that's why I'm looking at that question.
Member Holland, I just want to go a little bit this different direction for a minute. You know, I'm hopeful that at some point, for long years the university has said, your credit on the transcript means nothing. You know, these kids don't actually play through it as they have calculus and they, can't even do algebra, et cetera. I mean, I'm hopeful that this is a beginning step on a path that will give us some accountability measures we haven't had in the past. Not necessarily through our PEAKS assessments or, specific statewide and, of course, exam like we're talking about, but rather to have some and, of course, exams that maybe are vetted and have the good housekeeping seal of approval for districts to use, to choose from, so that we could, so that districts can choose to inject a little bit of accountability that might be recognized by the university system, might help us across the state have a little more consistency, a little like with a teacher evaluation system to give districts choices, Marzano Danielson, and not, in that case, a teacher evaluation system was required. I'm not sure we would even have to require that there be an of course exams, but have some systems that have been vetted by Alaska's educators that people have confidence in, that districts could then choose from and use with their students to inject more of a sense of what an algebra course is, what a geometry course is, and what the expectation might be for mastery. Because, as we've talked about modernization, that's kind of a foundational concept in how we move in that direction. So will be a challenge by giving each other.
Chair Hill, but if I could respond, just respond at the beginning. I did want to mention the connection to the university because, as Ben mentioned, our standards were adopted in 2012, and they are they're not grade specific; they're strand specific. And I think when many states were adopting these standards, they were kind of the bar for what students should have to get out of high school, and many states began testing in 11th grade. And we chose not to do that. So when we're testing in 9th and 10th grade, we can't assume students have had all of that content yet. But as part of our waiver, the university was required to look at our standards and give us an assurance that if a student met these standards, then they would not need to go into remedial courses. So that will be, as we're sharing this information, and it's really about what standards have been chosen for Algebra 1 to be tested as an ending course test. And as part of that process in June of 2014, there was also participation by university faculty on both the ELA and math teams to their staff. But we'll be sharing the standards with them and that course with them.
I'm going to move in a little bit different direction with question. I know this is topic for our working meeting is it will be briefed on the high school testing for spring 2018. And I've been asked some questions by folks out in the public, and I don't have the answer, so I'm hoping you help me with this. I think there's been some disappointment with some educators out there with how long it took between the test and the results. What's the expectation for next year? That was a question that was asked me. That time frame, and is there anything that if we're asked that question that we can respond back other than saying we need to contact the department?
To the chair, Member Harmon, the first year of the test has to go through the process of standard setting to determine where the cut points are for the achievement levels. And so that does necessitate a little bit longer time period because then it has to come to the board and there's the public comment period. So our hope is that, and the really good news is that those results were presented on time to the trip on the schedule that we had arranged, and have some of the results themselves, you know, are show that students are had a long way to go, but the report design, we've gotten good feedback on that. I don't have a firm date established that I can share today. We're talking with the vendor about what the timeline will be for next year, but because we have a 5-week test window, which doesn't end until, you know, essentially the end of April, it's unlikely that we'll have results before school is out, because some of our schools start, you know, closing in the middle of May, but we definitely should have them before the school starts. School year starts. I just can't give you a date today.
Okay. Look, and that information is helpful. I've been directing the department, but I think there's just questions out there. There's questions in the public because, in their mind, they think, well, you've given a test. Why can't you just tell us what the results are? And then, as we know, there are more details, but it's a little bit more complicated than that.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments? I am not seeing any. Thank you for your report.
Anna, Carrick is our new assessment administrator. She just came in. I just wanted to point her out. She put a face today.
Great. Thank you. Hi. Alaska Education Challenge update.
The board will receive an update on the work of the Alaska Education Challenge Committee. So, as the board knows, the Alaska Education Challenge is actually your work. You instigated this work with your strategic planning process even before I came on as commissioner. You've been working with former Commissioner Jerry Covey on this work even before I arrived here, and you continue to help with that. So, a couple things I want to say right at the beginning is, first of all, I want to congratulate the board on the work that's happened so far. I think the committee process, thanks to Santa, Jerry, the facilitators of each committee, and the board co-chairs, and then all the participants, has gone very well. That doesn't mean it's gone easy or that it's been without its frustrations or hard conversations, but for the most part, I think it's gone well, and so I congratulate the board on setting up a process that allowed that to happen. The exciting part, though, is that that phase of your visioneering for Alaska's public education system is winding down, and so we need to start thinking about what the board's next steps are in that process. And that's really what Jerry is going to focus on with you today, as well as talking about how you'll be spending some of your time on October 5th. So I think going into this conversation, the board should be enthused and appreciative of the work that's gone on so far. If I started naming folks that we need to thank, I would certainly leave a ton out. So I would say almost anybody that you come across in the department deserves a pat on the back for the work that they've done to make it go successfully so far. But in particular, I want to point out Aaron Harden, who has, and Jerry can speak to this, has really worked literally 9 days, Sundays, to make sure those committees go well, that there's technology available, that people are notified of those meetings, that resources are available. And so I know as the board has invested so much of your time and energy into strategic planning that you will want to know how much Aaron has made that possible for the board and made that successful. And then, of course, Santa, just her leadership at the department to make sure that all the other work of the department is geared toward the Alaska Education Challenge. And I can tell you, I've been in many meetings where Santa's the one that points everybody back to that process as being the center of our work. And then, of course, Jerry and the countless hours he's invested in each of those committee meetings, but also spending time anticipating what the board's next step should be in that role. So with that, I'm going to turn it over. But before I do, Tiffany, who is leaving the room, because she is doing everything. It was pointed out to me that the board members may not know who Tiffany is. She's sitting there with Sean. So Tiffany is our other board commissioner, deputy commissioner, secretary in the office, and she has been there a few months and has done an amazing job and really helps the office move along. And so she's going to be even more of a pivotal part of the office as we transition. So I just want to make sure everybody knows who Tiffany is and gives an opportunity to speak with her. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you, Commissioner. Good morning, everyone. My name is Jerry Kelly. I'm an education consultant, and I'm working with the department and the board on the Alaska Challenge process. And again, I'd like to thank all the board members for your work. This has really been a roll-up-your-sleeve endeavor. And as a result of your hard work, we sit here today on the verge of moving forward with a board that has a deep understanding of where we are and how we got here and an appreciation for where we must go to make this a reality. This morning I'd like to engage you in conversation about the future, share with you some ideas, learn from you some of your ideas, understand your concerns a little bit better, and share information about those concerns. Because really, where we go is uncharted territory for the state. And there is no roadmap. We, you, as a board of policymakers, will create the map based upon the best information available to you. You will find a way forward. Which, by the way, is what we've done every time we've had major change in education. Lessons have found our own way forward. When we created the first set of standards, we found our own way forward. When we revised those standards, we found our own way forward. And that's what we're tasked with at this point in time as well. The commissioner mentioned Erin working night and day. Well, I just add that she worked weekends too. And I know that because she contacted me on weekends. So the work is tremendous and vital to the progress we've made. This morning I'd like to share information with you about drivers for education change, right drivers and wrong drivers. And as a part of that, we will talk about our next step and how we will go about building a pathway forward. I'm going to say a lot of work from Michael Fullan. And when I say Michael Fullan, I mean Michael Fullan and all the other change leaders that he has worked with over the years. And I'll talk more in detail about that. But I'd like to kind of bring us back to the present. Our conversation right there. And please, folks, as we're working through this, stop me at any time. This is a conversation that we're sharing. It's not a presentation where you're being asked to sit and listen. So, as a state, as many of you know, we've been here before. We've had numerous plans that were developed and brought forward. We've engaged Alaskans, sometimes hundreds of Alaskans, intensely over periods of time to develop recommendations. In every case, they brought forth strong recommendations for change. But for some reason, those have not translated into significant change in our system. They're all embraced initially. We go forward with a high amount of energy and enthusiasm, but over a short period of time, those plans have wound up on the shelf, like most plans do. And so why is that happening? Why do we have a history of that? It's really a question for us to explore. Our system is designed to operate the way it does currently. Our system is structured around external accountability. We just talked about state tests. We've had state tests for many, many years. It's internal accountability is part of the equation. Individualism, we have 53 districts who have tremendous authority at the local level, who have control of vast amounts of their education resources to do what they want to do with in a way that suits them largely. We favor outstanding teachers, we favor outstanding principals, as we should, but we do not favor outstanding group work. Our system is not designed to do that. We, like most other states, have bought in largely into educational technology with the idea that it would give us the boost we needed, but it hasn't. And it cannot by itself do that. It's part of the equation, but it is not the answer. We have federal policymaking bodies that are always looking at ways to improve the education system. We have legislation, we have regulation, we have local policy development, all going on simultaneously in a largely uncoordinated fashion. And we've been doing it that way for 50 years. It's almost as if we have many engineers that are working on independently on improving the system in a non-coordinated way. The intent is great. The desire is great. We're all after the same thing, but we're not making the best use of our resources in our efforts to improve it. There's a compliance focus that we live with, and there's a tremendous silo effect. It goes on within our system. I'm talking system now. I'm not talking local schools, and I'm not talking local school districts. We do see evidence of some of these things, some strong evidence of some of these things occurring at the local and district level, and even the beginning of some significant collaboration between districts at this point, which clearly is the direction that we see at where the opportunity is as we go forward. Additionally, we suffer from fatigue. We have too many priorities. We have too many things going on at the same time as a system and in school district to successfully address. We have too much bureaucracy. When people try to flex and create and collaborate and work together, they bump into barriers that are beyond their control to address. There is no elbow room within the system, significant elbow room for people to do what they need to do to work together to bring about the changes. Additionally, in terms of internal capability and capacity, systemically, we're not designed to do that, and we do not have currently the capacity. We have to build the capacity. We have to create the connections to allow school districts, to allow individual teachers to work with other teachers and districts to work with other districts to create the changes that we're looking for. So it's really a different mindset that you are looking for. Transforming how we work together to accomplish your mission. Mindset, because when we change our minds, we change our opportunities. We have, going to look at some other realities. Before we get into the recommendations, which I don't envision we will today to any significant degree, we have to ask ourselves, how do we get beyond these constraints that we have? We have limited capability and capacity. We have very diverse wants and priorities within our system. We're not on the same sheet of music. We have limited experience with collaboration at the system level, and we have not built our system around bottom-up accountability. And as you will see, systems across the globe that are performing at a high level have addressed the problem of accountability. And part of the challenge we face with top-down accountability is it will never get us where we need to go. When we look at high-performing schools, high-performing districts, we see they have figured out how to work together, how to be accountable at their level. We'll look at some examples of how that's happening in other places. The ideas that I'm sharing with you come largely from Michael Polan, as I mentioned, and his associates. Polan is a global consultant who has worked for about 25 or 30 years in many different countries. He started in England in the 90s, tackling what they called at the time numeracy and literacy, because England is a country that has very low literacy rate and very low math skill rate. What they found in the 90s was that the literacy and numeracy rate had been the same since World War II. It had not changed. And so systemically, they had to tackle it. He also served as an advisor to the Minister of Education in Ontario for 11 years, during which time Ontario retooled their education system, and Ontario, as you could guess, has many similarities to our system. It went from being a very low-performing system to a world-class education system. He has worked in across Australia, he's worked in New Zealand, he's worked in many states in the U.S., and he's worked with several school districts in the U.S. And along the way, there's a large group of people that he works with and collaborates with. And what this does, it pulls together what works, the best research, the best evidence, the best documentation of how school districts have found ways and how systems have found ways to succeed over the last 30 years. And it challenges the very structure of the education system that we operate in this state. He talks about four drivers, and that's really what I'd like to engage you about this morning, and that's where I believe the opportunities for conversation occur. And these are the drivers that successful systems have used over the last 30 years to bring about the change. First of all, is focus and direction. We'll dive into each one of these. The second is cultivating collaborative cultures. We have a recommendation coming forward from one of our committees on collaboration. The third one is deepening learning. And the fourth one is fulfilling accountability, and I touched on that briefly already. From bottom up and top down direction. So, the wrong changes, the wrong drivers of education, these are the drivers that primarily have been used in the United States and Australia, neither of which have made significant gains or improvements in the system. Cumulative accountability. All we have to do is think NCLD. That's how our system works, top down. Individualistic strategies, we are not structured or positioned to move together as a group, as districts. We are set up to move individually. We have an over reliance on technology, you could phrase that in other ways, the lack of understanding of how to make the best use of our technology. And as I mentioned earlier, we have ad hoc policies. Indicators. Focus and direction. We get into this. We talked about really here, this is a conversation about the principles of effective leadership. And what we find is that in systems that are performing very highly, it's not the top-down control structure that we have. The structure is much different. People in that system learn together. They tackle common problems together. You must have structure. You must have alignment. But those alone do not produce these types of results. Another thing is engagement. We see within the system people at all levels are engaged. It's not the superintendent or the principal comes to the end of the meeting and says, this is how it's going to be. There's a phrase that they use that you should be right, you should have the right idea at the end of the meeting, not at the beginning of the meeting. At the beginning of the meeting, when you're trying to create something new and effective, no one can possibly have the right idea. We haven't figured it out yet. It's by working together, by school boards and superintendents and administrative teams and teacher teams all working together on common issues that creates the focus that we are looking for. And of course, we can't do that when we're at odds with each other. We can't do that in some cases, we have a strong labor management relationship. We do not have professional educator relationships. And then that's how we find that there's an opportunity to work beyond that. And the ideas coming forth will help you, will help us do that. We have to connect people together around a purpose. And we're going to look at some examples of how, what does that look like? And what does that result in? And we have to find ways to measure progress together. And measuring progress, we'll talk more about that. I think the conversation you just had is an important part of that. It's a step in the right direction. But it's not the only piece of that puzzle. Goals should have to be clear, connected, and consistent and concise. An example from Ontario. 8 school districts that were very low-performing school districts in literacy decided that they would work together without being told or directed by the Ministry of Education, without any other guidance or demand. Decided they would work together on literacy because they had a common problem. They were among the lowest performing school systems in Ontario at that time. And so they defined what they wanted in terms of literacy. They said literacy for them meant cultivating critical thinking. It had to include that. Literacy had to include problem solving. Literacy had to include communication. And it had to be taught across all grades and all content areas. The local decision. It's global. It affected their entire system. They didn't rely on external experts to tell them how to do it. They sat down with their common problem, and they determined what they were bumping up against and what they were bumping into to try to address this issue. And they created, because if their system operates in some way similar to ours, the resource is at that level. The money is at that level. The human talent is at that level. It's not at the department level. And it's not above there. So if there's an opportunity to address this, it's at that level. What they needed was the elbow room to get regulations and requirements that were imposed on them out of the way so they could put their energy to a common problem. And they did, and they addressed it, and they turned it around within 3 years. They were very successful. results and those results have continued. And the gap between that group of schools and the high-performing group of schools narrowed considerably. So it's that opportunity to identify where we want to go and what we want to work on. Alaska Challenge is bringing forth those types of opportunities for us. You will be sitting in front of recommendations in each of your areas of your objective to advance ideas or to engage the school systems and the educators on these ideas and find out where we can connect, where can we get started with this moving things forward. So one way is get things out of the way, eliminate preliminaries or preconditions, get clear and get going on things. We either move too quickly to get commitments from people, or we talk things to death. We have to figure out at the district what do they want and how do they do it. What I'm going to ask here, you have, from your work, your own examples of people who have done things like this. Where have you observed, or what evidence do you identify of people who have made significant progress on big time issues in this system?
Well, I can think of some examples. You know, maybe let's not use the current one, though I think there is an effort with among some school districts to collaborate and begin to do this kind of work. But rather than using a near example, maybe an example further back, there were some districts that led relative to mastery and competency, but then it didn't spread. On the other hand, relative to homeschool work and a kind of out of the box thinking relative to alternative schools. You know, we've had alternative schools before, but then there became kind of a new movement about what an alternative school could be, that then you had three different districts that collaborated and began to talk about how they were approaching that task differently, and then it kind of changed it for all of us. So that other districts are saying, you know, why are they being so successful in this kind of out-of-the-box thinking? So I think we've seen pockets of that.
Thank you.
I would say, yeah, you're right, it's pockets, and even in the Cup River School District Commissioner, when he was superintendent, a lot of collaboration, a lot of what do you think of different ideas, getting community members involved, getting the teachers involved, basically all stakeholders involved long before any decisions made. And really seek out what are the problems, what are the advantages. So then, you know, before you just throw a new idea on the community, it's been vetted, it's been so they know what's coming, and it's really been talked through. And like you say, the idea may be out there, but the end result has not been predefined. Mm-hmm. It's really seeking really what the end result should be in a collaborative way.
Thank you. Those are great examples, and actually we're going to kind of take a break those down a little bit and look at what research tells us that supports what you're saying about this type of change as we go forward. So this idea of collaboration is, in my view, the most significant, most important element of this type of work. If we're going to change, if you are going to lead a change, a successful change in our education system, it is going to be built around and it's going to be built upon collaboration in greater degrees than we have ever experienced. And that collaboration will require some significant prompting and some significant support from your level. Because if it's not fed, it cannot produce, as evidence shows us, it only works at the local level. We have a tendency to just reduce, reframe, remove. We start talking about change, and then we look at all the things we need to move, and then we start looking at all the realities we have, and we find ourselves right back in the same place. If we're going to change things, we have to reduce, we have to narrow down what it is we want to change. We have to reframe it, change people's minds, engage people, give them a reason to participate, and we have to get barriers out of their way that will allow these changes to be sustained. And the fragmentation part is that people get left behind. Change, I heard the analogy that creating system change is kind of like a marathon. We have elite runners who go out first. They already know the change. The change that for them is simple, it's easy. They know what they're doing, they know how to do it, they know why to do it, and they're gone. Behind them, we have another group of runners that pretty much get it. They're over the top in terms of change. They're supportive, they're willing to figure it out. Behind them, we have a group who is in the middle. They're not certain. They don't know what it means. They don't know if they should support it or resist it. Behind them, we have a group who perhaps is not even aware that change is in the works. They're at the tail end of the line. And when we set about to create system change, we have to bring everyone into the loop. James just referenced that in his conversation about his example of how it worked at a local district. We have to do the same thing statewide. We can't leave people behind. One of the reasons change hasn't worked in the past is because we didn't bring people along. So
I can give you some good examples of that.
Go ahead. So it's critical that we stay together on this. Ownership is what gets rid of resistance. Engagement. When we talked way back at the beginning of this slide about communicating with people who disagreed with you, who were cynical of you, who were opposed to what you were doing, and just taking the high road and keeping them in the loop all the way along, then it's why we have to do that. Somewhere along the line, the question has to be answered, what's in it for me? For the people who are cynical. If we can answer that question, we can gain their support. This is how we've done change. We align our policy, our resources, our skill development, and we provide support for that. That's the traditional way. It's slow, it's cumbersome, it does not get the buy-in. It's basically more top-down than bottom-up. And because of that, it has produced the success we want. If we look at what we're seeing in other states and what we're seeing in high-performing nations, the directional support comes from the top, the vision. The support for sustained cycles of innovation. We have states in our nation that are well into this, into innovative pathways, and they're learning, they're making mistakes, but they're figuring it out, they're engaging students, they're engaging their communities in new ways, and they're producing results that are significantly higher. And very appealing and very, very much supported at the local level. There is no ultimate authority in these systems. There is ultimate opportunity, and there's people coming together to work around things that are high value to them.
Member Holt, I think we need a little more conversation about this diffusion of practice and the same cycles of innovation. That's scary to folks, because, you know, on our committees, Barbara will probably think of some examples of, and on the modernization committee as well, you know, folks are like, well, we'll mandate this, you know, and so we keep going back to the word mandatory and saying, well, you know, is that the only way it could be done? That notion of having it be diffused, having people collaborating voluntarily, is not the historical way. So could you talk a little bit more about how we all have confidence that opening things up will lead to the gains we want, because we're so familiar with that other system.
Very good. Thank you. Yes, I can speak to that, and perhaps some of you can speak to it as well. It is, everything you said, it's pretty fearful. It's not how we do business. We're far more comfortable with the status quo, even though no one is satisfied with the status quo. That's just human nature. And so all of these uncertainties are very challenging for us. So what an example out of some of Poland's work in school in Australia, they began a program that was put together by a principal and a group of teachers within the school, and whereby they were going to support a system, you know, voluntary for teachers. They were going to support a system whereby teachers and would go in and watch other teachers work and then meet with them and do kind of a collaborative effort on how do we improve everyone's practice. And initially, it was a school of 30, 40 teachers or something like that, and very few takers initially. There was a small group of people. And so Poland and his group were doing work in that school at the time, and they interviewed and they engaged people, and they found out why they were doing it or why they were opting not to do it, and it was all the reasons you mentioned. We don't know what this will mean. It may make us look weird. It might be an attack on us. And so 3 years later, they come back to the school. Every teacher in the school is involved in this program. We have similar programs in Alaska. That Collin Middle School does a program just like that, and there may be others. They're all voluntary. And what happens is when you do that, you have to start small with a group of people. You have to allay the fears of others. You can't mandate. You can't force people to collaborate. You have to create an opportunity and provide evidence and invite and help people get beyond where they are so that they can move forward. And as we look at some of the types of cross district multiple district collaboration, we're starting to see those same things have had to be resolved. John?
And a lot of these examples you're sharing remind me of the book, Who Moved My Cheese, which discusses, you know, the challenge of change. You know, and I think about this and think about the project we're working on. I think one thing comes to mind to me, you know, I know there's conflict and there's resistance sometimes to change, and even if the conflict is respectful, because we want this to be successful, and we're going through, hopefully, to remove some barriers. And I know we've been focusing on in our groups on the what, not the how. But, for example, I know we've had some discussions in at least a subcommittee, not even a committee, but a subcommittee that I'm on related to alternative pathways and stuff like that. And there's a little bit of respectful conflict on, you know, what does that mean, where are we going to go? I guess one of the concerns I have is if an idea comes up, because we've done the what, is it going to get stopped when we start getting into the how, and how can we avoid that from happening? And, you know, I don't know if this is the time to have a discussion about that potential, or if we wait until later. Because again, what I've heard on the, at least the subcommittee level, not the committee, is, well, that's the how, let's not worry about it till later. So, you know, I think it's great if we can get the what, but if we never ever get to the how, we're never going to make these changes. And it goes back to those things you initially identified, whether it's bureaucracy or any other challenges that, you know, people are excited, they want to change, everybody's on board, but sometimes it doesn't happen. I just don't want that to happen in this situation. So, I don't know, thoughts, comments?
Well, I appreciate you raising that issue because it is the capital issue before us. And there's a reason, of course, that we separated at the committee level the what and the how. The what is the policy, and the what is the purview of this board? How do we support through policy those types of changes? The how, the how is really figured out at the next stage, at the next level. The how from the department level is your responsibility and mission. How do I support these changes? But first of all, we have to figure out what opportunities will come from these presentations that you're about to receive. And after you spend a day by yourself with your staff going through these and learning more about them in depth, what will you see as perhaps the most significant and greatest opportunities that we can put before others, before school districts to engage them? But for a committee to tell someone now how to do something that they haven't even been introduced to, we've got the cart before the horse, essentially. We have to engage them to figure out how. If we go in there and say, we need a law to do this, we need a regulation to do that, we're reverting back to the very same strategies that have not moved the system. People have to own the change. And when people own the change, when people work in teams, as these eight school districts did in Ontario, they own the problem. They figured out the solution. They put their resources in there. No one told them they had to do that. They decided to do it. They were much like a team that wanted to win, and they had to figure out how to win. And so it's fine to make some strategies or some hows. It's fine to give them a list of hows, but not to require them to use that list of hows, because they may come up with a better how than we can imagine from our end. Does that help?
Yeah, and I agree with you. We want to come up with the weather, but we just don't want to get to the next level until it's the right time and the right building and collaboration support. I know we all want to see this successful. So I'm just, you know, to the extent we're thinking about the potential challenges to that end result, I think it's important that we're having these thoughts and discussions. I'm just trying to think, because already, you know, at least in the subcommittees, you're having some of these debates where there's the resistance piece and there's some of the other things. So I don't know, when we get to selecting an idea, do we select the most transformational ideas that have the resistance in our committees? I mean, I don't know what that's going to be at the next step. Or do we go with something, yeah, there was a lot of discussion back and forth that this is something we really do, and maybe that's not a meeting, not a discussion we have or something that's answered until October 5th, but it's something to think about, I believe.
So Mr. Johnson, I'll just add, you know, I think this is consistent with some things that I said at the beginning of the PK challenge, and that is, we have to inspire local communities to demand great schools. And when I say that, I'm not implying that they don't want great schools now. I'm focusing on the inspiration part of it. And I also said, you know, we're not going to be able to regulate, legislate, or dictate better schools in this state. And I know that's true because every state in the country has tried it that way. And if there was a regulation or a piece of legislation or an administrative dictation to make a school better, we would have seen it. Nobody has found that secret yet. But when communities whether that's a local community, a state, or whatever, just like, we are going to have a great school. Then there's a great school, in spite of everything else. And so I think the board inspires local communities through this process by saying the what, and make that inspirational. How that fleshes out in every community in the state, and Alaska is a perfect example of this. We're so diverse and different. How that fleshes out in each of our communities will be different and beautiful in their own unique ways when those local communities choose it. And they may choose a different combination of the what than a community downriver or somewhere else. And I think that's rich. And that's why I'll connect it with some other things that I said. I think the department has two big functions going forward, and that's reporting and resources. So instead of just collecting data so that we know things, we very deliberately, as a State Department of Education, collect data to report. And that reporting is a service we can provide to every district in the state. And that means we have to be more robust in our data collection and our data reporting. And we give that information along with the what to communities to inspire them to demand a great school. And if they have that information, then we also are a resource on the other end. And I don't think we provide all the services, but we have some great associations in this state, the Alaska School Boards Association, the Superintendents Association, ALASBO, the Council on Disabilities and Special Education, the Alaska Early Childhood Council, that can come in and help districts, come alongside districts when they're inspired to have better schools. And I think if you look at the comments, I just, the Superintendent Association providing comments for HESA last night, and, you know, as I read through that, I saw that in their comments. You know, we want to make sure there's an emphasis on community engagement in school improvement, not necessarily a script of the how. So I think we're on the right track in making sure that the board does what its function should be, and then we look to districts to do. Will there be some communities or districts, not districts, will there be some places that may not choose what we would want them to choose? Maybe so. But I think the vast majority will choose better schools, and if we're there to provide the reporting and the resource that will that happen, I think we'll see improvement. I'm confident we'll see improvement.
Thank you.
Senator Thompson, I understand why people want to mandate and legislate, because they feel if there's something concrete, then you can't stay on it, and you have to do it. At some level, you have to do it. But I think there's been so many movements, so many programs that have been great on the right track. There's buy-in. But I think what we don't have are the tools to deal with changes in leadership. You've got buy-in from superintendents. You've got buy-in from the board. You've got buy-in from legislators or the governor. And then within 4 years, everything changes. And you're left with a temporary void. And with all the superintendent turnover, principals, teachers in some areas of the state, I think what we're missing is the ability to carry on and know how to do that in the face of those high-profile people who are leading the charge. They retire, they leave, they get sick and move on to something else. So it's all about staying the course and having the ability to, I go back to fidelity of implementation of all these ideas. Mm-hmm. But you can get derailed so fast when all of a sudden your leader's gone, your community leader's gone, your staff, your teachers are gone. So I think we're coming up with great recommendations, but that whole ability to hold on to them when they're not legislated and mandated through that kind of a change, leadership change, and
I think we haven't been good at figuring out how to ride through those times.
Thank you for your comment. And I'm not saying, no one is saying, in any of this work, that we don't need legislation and structure. We do. But what the emphasis has been of this sort of, and as Sue mentioned, James mentioned, we do have examples in our state of things that, that came from the bottom up, that, that were woven into our current system. Charter schools, residential schools, homeschooling, and we know it today, a number of changes that you, many of you have been engaged in that are systemic now, regardless of who's in leadership positions at the local or state level, they are part of the system. And so those did not come down from the top. Those came from the bottom. And when we look at the example that I shared with you of these Ontario schools where eight of the eight districts got together, pooled their resources and came up with one priority, that's bottom up. But when they're working on that, it puts the Ministry of Education in a very different position to provide support and assistance for their efforts. Because they didn't have eight targets to shoot at from the department level. They have one. They have one common goal. So it's better use of the resource by focusing. And that's why we have to go back to the real kingpin of all this is collaboration and ownership and engagement. You are going to have 15 ideas put in front of you. This state, as far as I know, does not have the capacity to advance on 15 ideas simultaneously. So somewhere along the line, it will have to be determined which are the most viable opportunities. When we engage with people at the school level and the community level, what it is the ones that they want to latch on to first and go with, and then how can we use these drivers to support their efforts so that these things won't happen. If you came up with five things that were critical, that changed the education system that was sustainable over a long period, we could go in a very different direction. That's just 5 out of 15. So we're tasked with not only figuring out how to engage people, we're tasked with figuring out what comes first. And we're going to have to figure that out because, first of all, you don't have the recommendations yet. And you haven't had a chance to share them with people around the state yet who are involved in education to get their feedback on what they see as the most attractive and viable and critical steps to take up. So, again, we're going to some place where there is no man. And what the research and what Solman says is that these are the drivers that successful systems have used to get there. And we have to be vigilant and mindful of those really concerns all the way through all four of these things, because any one of them can derail us.
Can I just make a quick comment? Barbara's absolutely right, but that's a culture. It's so important. Then it's not dependent on a leader or a board or, you know, the change that inevitably comes, the change of a culture, and everybody connected to it, so that then the ideas are naturally sustained, not artificially foisted on people. That notion of culture, and it's scary, this whole notion of the fusion of practice, you know, of letting it go. Is kind of scary to people. And when we talk about inspiration, you know, the commissioner was saying, you know, the reporting can be inspiration. Well, sometimes the reporting is pretty depressing, but in a way, that's also inspirational. I think right now, with regard to student performance data, that's the case. You know, everybody goes, what? You know, how does this happen in our state? And then it inspires people to think about how we'll get the schools to turn.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I'll just say, in addition to culture, it's about attitude. And if I look at student achievement data, and I'm depressed about it or I'm inspired by it, that's an attitude that I bring to the table. And I think the disposition of the Department of Education is, or I'm hoping to lead this kind of disposition, is that, and I would say it's true for the board too, we don't assume that we care more about student achievement than the teachers in those classrooms, or the principals in those schools, or the superintendents in those districts. Because if we start with an assumption that we care more about student achievement than they do, then we'll start trying to dictate, legislate, regulate to make schools better. If we start with the assumption and the respectfulness and honoring that they care as much or more about their students' learning as we do, then we will come alongside and form true partnerships to improve the education system.
And I'll just make a comment of Barbara and the commissioner. It's easy to legislate. It's easy to dictate. I mean, that's a lot easier than trying to bring people along, however you want to call it. And then I think about inspiration. Can you be inspiring if the people you're trying to inspire don't trust you? Can you be inspiring if you're not credible? You can't. So inspiration requires relationship. It requires credibility, which I believe these committees bring in over 100 different individuals from around the state bring that in. But I think you're asking the right questions. It's a lot harder to do it this way, but you're going to get a lot better results. I think this board is in the right place. I think we've got good leadership, the commission that will bring that credibility, that will bring that trust level, because it's not easy. But we can want to inspire all we want, but if we're not credible, it's not going to matter. And credibility takes time. It takes process. It takes stability, and I believe we're getting there. It just takes time. So these are the right questions we're asking. So.
Thank you. I'm going to try to speed this up a bit. Otherwise, we're going to run out of time. The second driver is cultivating collaborative cultures. And we've been into this a lot already in our conversation. The collaborative work is the most important work we're going to do, and that's how we get there together. We have been said selfish, and nobody should assume they care more than anyone else. Everyone involved in education is involved because they want something good to happen for the children of the state and for the future of the state. People put their heart and soul and their life's work into this for a reason, to create something better. And I think that's our beginning point right there, is that we all care equally, and we're all doing our best, and that's the starting point to work together. So looking at these leadership actions, matter more than words, we've talked about this. It's not the top-down approach. It's to sit down and roll up our sleeves, we'll figure this out together approach. If you're going to try it, as Chair Field said, if you're going to try something new in the community, you bring people together, you have a conversation, you start understanding where the resistance is, where the fear is, where the opportunity is, and you work through that and you go forward together. You don't tell them this is going to happen. We've talked about this already. 100 people have been working for months for no money, no compensation. They've been giving up their time. They've been giving up a lot of time. They've been thinking hard. They've been wrestling with difficult ideas because they care, because they want to do something good for the children of Alaska. They want to do something to make this a better state to live in. And everybody wants to be on a rising star. Everybody wants to be on winning teams. And people will work really hard if they see the opportunity as real, if they have confidence and trust, and if they respect them. Social capital is worth far more than human capital. And social capital is what we have not as a system, as a state system, we have not built upon the social capital. We haven't developed that asset. And if we do that, we will get the engagement and the collaboration that we have. The other one is the learning leadership. The leader's job is to build collaboration. It's not to have the answers. Everybody has to be a continuous leader. That means when at the building level, when the professional development is on reading or language arts, the principals in that meeting, right along with everyone else, it means that the superintendent and the directors have some understanding. They're there. They know what's going on. It's not, okay, I bought this, we're going to train you in this, so we'll do this. It's understanding what are the shortcomings, the limitations of this program, and how do we as a group get beyond those limitations? That's the type of engagement that we are looking at. It's the cornerstone, capacity building. There's no shortage of human resource. There's no shortage of physical resource. There's a shortage of connections of resource. Talked about this already. And that only happens when people sit down together. All levels of engagement. So it's collaborative work is the major work we're doing. And Sue is co-chair of the committee that's been working on this, and I've been very excited about the recommendation they're working on. And I keep saying this applies far more than to modernization. This applies to the work of the entire system. And I think you'll see that it does as they bring it forward. Deep learning, awareness, understanding. I want to talk about deep learning. This is really interesting. This is something that's been coming out of the Poland's work, but it's coming out across the globe now. And what they're saying is that with deep learning, the six C's, communication, critical thinking, collaboration, creativity, character, and citizenship, are global skills, global student skills. And that's what other systems are deliberately teaching. They're weaving that into their education delivery. And it's far more expansive than we have worked on historically as a system. But as a system, if we, and I heard from listening to committees work, Alaska Challenge committees, I heard conversations about character and conversations about citizenship and the importance of those things. And what we're seeing is that others are leading this right into their collaborative work as they go forward. Precision in pedagogy accelerated by digital capability. We have our foot in the door here. We have some Milwaukee committees in this. And it's the precision in pedagogy. If we go back and look at the example of eight schools that work together, they had to come up with precision to address their needs. And it wasn't top-down, store-bought precision. Homegrown precision was based upon the skills and understandings of people at that level. And that's the only way they could get where they needed to go.
Okay, can I just jump in with Member Hall again about that? This notion of precision in pedagogy, it relates to our conversation about in the course exam. And it relates to how do you get at the precision in pedagogy without mandating, without using our old systems, but nevertheless, to drive the kind of change that took those systems. And one of the things that I liked in Poland's work was this notion of tight loops. That in those systems, there were, you know, tighter controls in certain areas in order to get, build the culture to get to where some others were. So I just wanted to throw in this, you know, it just sounds so simple, precision and pedagogy, but we've got to find a way to get there in our system.
Thank you for raising that point, and that also came up in the McKinsey & Company report, and they talk about the types of precision that are used in schools at different ranges of performance, and that's where that tight loop concept came from. And it's very attractive and appealing, and it supports people at the level of their performance so that they can collaborate and work together. Thanks for bringing that forward. This is a very interesting concept, and we've heard it, we've used this, we've discussed this in different terms, but it comes out of research, I can't remember who developed it specifically, but the concept of simplicity, the smallest number of potentially interrelated elements that feed on each other to create success. And it's really an important concept as we look at how we're going to create the changes. That's the elbow room. That's giving people the flexibility to relax some of the requirements that are binding them on, that are constraining them, so that they can do their work. And it's something that comes from the bottom up. They can tell us what types of latitude are needed to accomplish certain things. You will have before you recommendations to do a lot of different things, and they're going to require some change at the system level to give people these opportunities. And so the complexity concept that plays nicely into that. This deep learning idea is really the deep end of the pool, figure out how to go forward. It's what happens at the local level when people come together and solve problems and get different results. What others have found is that they have to do the same thing at the system level, across the system. It's to support deep learning. And if we can identify common areas of common interest and concern, then we can find ways to support that level of understanding. Bumping into the problems and finding ways to get beyond them is what we should do. And it can't be first. It can only be generated locally. Internal accountability, this is the fourth driver. Our system is built around external accountability. We've talked some about that. The definition up there is pretty straightforward. Internal accountability occurs when individuals and groups take on personal, professional, and collective responsibility for continuous improvement and the success for all students. We have not built our public education system around internal accountability. We have built it around external accountability. And external accountability, well, let me just go on a little bit more. And it's investing in conditions to develop internal accountability. It's more important than the meaning of external accountability. It's the missing element in our accountability system. Who controls quality in our system? We try to control quality from the top down. We've been trying that since statehood. What evidence do we have that controlling quality from the top down is working well? We don't have evidence to show that it's working well. But if we reverse that, if you look at a good school, a good teacher, a good district, a good program that goes across districts, it's bottom up. People figure it out themselves and they own it. It's like a team. You can bring together basketball players with a lot of skill, that if they don't do those things, those internal things, to work together, to learn together, to play together, to realize how to win together, they can't win. It doesn't matter how much talent they have individually. We have to do a lot more with internal accountability systemically. Ask who controls quality in education. 8,000 teachers control quality. We have no systemic way to control quality. Yet we're held accountable by external standards for quality. Tests, federal requirements, state requirements. So building that capacity on the other end is a great opportunity for us. Questions? Yes, John.
And, I agree with that. I think in my field, models and role models are very important as it relates to this internal accountability at the state level, not necessarily a school or a district level. Are you aware of any states that would be able to serve as a role model that we could look to that have been very successful with their internal accountability?
Well, I thank you for your question. I think I go back to Ontario because that is systemically, I mean, they have many similarities to us. There's a large geographic area that is spread out. They have many school districts. They have a large indigenous population. They have networks of public and private schools. They, in many ways, are similar. And they have examples of how they do that. Those eight schools that banded together. And there are many more examples. I just picked one because it's an easy one.
But Ontario is an important example because they made the change in such short time, over a period of 6 years. That's lunacy, you know, to really be able to shift performance. And the external thing, you talk about the 8,000 teachers. Well, people have tried to get at that nut with performance pay and all kinds of other things that are all the wrong drivers that result in exactly the opposite of what was intended. Mm-hmm. So it is back to building the culture. But Ontario is a good example of how that culture work can be done in a relatively short period of time.
Thank you. Yes, Rebecca.
Rebecca, can you hear? I think spelled out for me really clearly. What are we doing on October 5th with this information? So on the 4th, we're going to hear from people, fairly distilled, fine-tuned goals and rationales. And then what happens on the 6th? Can I prepare? Can I study? Can I call 53 superintendents or 8,000 teachers, or what needs to happen on the 5th? Can you help me make sure I'm prepared and maybe guide me to the expectations that way?
Thank you for your question. Yes, I think we can, that's a great question to go right now at the end of this. What we want to do on the 5th is go deep with each one of these recommendations. You're going to hear the 30-man presentation, 3 recommendations. On the 5th, we propose, and I can read in the commission about this, we propose to spend the day on the 5th recommendations and explore in some significant depth what they mean, what the potential is. We will have access on that day to your department support staff that has been working with each of the committees. In addition to that, you are state board members that co-chair those committees. So we have more information to share. We want to, on that day, have time to ask questions. What does that mean? What does that look like? What do we think of that collectively? We're going to go through these, and at the end of the day, you're going to have more information to work with. But how do we go forward from there? How do we engage school districts? Do you try to identify what are the most important 3 or 5? What steps are we going to take I think we're going to have to figure that out together, frankly, because as we look at what other systems have done, they have to wrestle with this. Now, it may become very evident to you where it's going next, but it may not. And so, since we haven't done this before, we've got to find our way through it. And I will continue to look in the interim time about how other systems have moved from where you are going in terms of getting this information to the next steps. I'll bring that information to you to share with you how other systems have worked their way through this to get to the next stage.
I think it's okay. I have two comments. My first comment is, I understand the realities, but it would be nice if the 100 people who've been working on this were also there on this list, and I can see why that wouldn't be possible, but they're our best advocates. They've done this work, they've engaged with us, they've given us direction, and I just want to know that there's a plan for them going forward, that this doesn't stop here. Yes, we made our October 4th deadline, but whatever conclusions we reach, those people who brought us to that point are some of the best placed and most informed people to help carry the goal, the decision forward. And then I'm just curious, Gary, if you could, Gary, you talked about Australia and specifically Alaska sort of lagging and not making great progress. I've read a few things about rural education in Australia, and a lot of what we're talking about here seems more doable if we were more tightly, more densely located. So building a cultural change across the distances that we deal with feels daunting, and I'm not saying it can't be done, and in fact I'm not excited thinking that maybe we'll get it done, but I'd be curious what research is out there on how that barrier is going to overcome. If it's a barrier, maybe that's perception I have that's not supported, but I'm really curious how other places have made changes. For example, in Finland, are there great successes applicable also in the Sami population or in rural Finland? And if you can direct me to some reading, I could do, I'd love it.
Thank you. Ontario does have some significant evidence of showing how they have done that. And they diversified how they operate the system, how they control the system. It's no longer a state-controlled system. I mean, they have local control, but they also have tribal control within local control. They have different types of agreements and arrangements. All within the system. So they have found ways to engage people in spite of the distances and the challenges they face. And in addition to that, I think we find some challenges exist within urban districts also, even though they're close together. And they don't have those challenges. They sometimes have other challenges that are difficult to overcome. But I would be happy to converse with you and share with you information about what Ontario has done in those areas.
I think, as you remember, I think another way to look at that is the opportunity here, even despite our distance, we're really connected. You know, 129,000 kids is a relatively small system. And people know each other across the state through the associations, et cetera. There are ways, you mentioned the 100 people that have come together. They are connected to all different organizations. So the goal is to spread to have them become the change agents out and multiply the influence of the effort because they've been part of it. So they don't become an exclusive 100, they just become kind of the fertilizer, if you will, or the sourdough starter, you know, within a system that's relatively small when you consider under a million people, you know, 500, 600,000 people. But we do have to get it outside of those of us who are the insiders. We've got to get it out to the public.
And that, I thank you for coming. That's done through the association. It's done through other professional organizations throughout the state, getting the word out through chambers, different civic organizations, state-based organizations, industry, business. They all have a stake in it. And I think if I see an opportunity to roll up the sleeves and participate and help that's genuine, they will. We need 100 people perceive this as a genuine opportunity, and they work harder. If we can communicate this accurately and appropriately, I believe we can bring in far more people that are willing to work together. Sue was correct. We only have 53 districts in the state. That's a very small number. Everyone in Alaska knows everyone else. That's a district. And we know how to work together when we have the opportunity. So this becomes an opportunity. And I think we will look again at that, hopefully on the 5th, in terms of our next steps. Not only what items are of high value to begin with, but how do we engage people in the short term? And the commissioner has been spending quite a bit of time with me on the next steps, and I'm looking at how other systems are doing it, and looking at engaging the expertise of experts that have worked with other systems to get their insight and input into the work we're doing. Although this is new for us, it's not new for others. We're not in this alone. There's a lot of people, countries and states and organizations that have gone before us, and we can learn from them. And we're certainly open to doing that. And so I think both the challenge and the opportunity is for the state board to model the types of collaboration that the system must model to go forward.
Great, thank you for your presentation. We're a little bit over our time, which is fine. This is obviously an important topic. I would just mention every member should have access to all the smart sheets, all the different committees, so you could at least kind of go over the notes of the committee, you know, the subcommittees, and get some information that way.
I have access to two of them, and I thought I had to request to get the access, or...
You should have access to all of them, not, and we can get it to you, because that was one thing that was brought up before, that all board members can have access, so you can look at the notes of every committee.
Right. So I've been looking at the following two, but I'm really curious about the other.
Yeah, you should be able to get it. If you don't, let
it should be on the top of your smart sheet.
Yeah. So that may help you get up to date before the 4th. So thank you, Jerry, for all your work, and I look forward to the 4th and 5th. And I think we'll take our 15-minute break. It is 11:13, so we'll come back at 11, and we'll just instead of up to 30.
It's 11:30, so we'll go ahead and begin after our break. And the next item is approval for UAA Early Childhood Special Education Program. Dr. Johnson, Commissioner Johnson.
All right. The University of Lafayette expanded its offering to teaching candidates completing their bachelor's program in early childhood education to include an optional minor in early childhood special education. In order for UAA to recommend candidates completing the early childhood special education minor for an additional enforcement area on their teaching certificate, the state board must approve the program.
For the record, Sandra Meredith, Administrator for Teachers of Education. UAA has two programs now that directly related to what they're expanding one into. They've had for a long time the early childhood education bachelor's degree that led to the teaching certificate for pre-K through third grade. And they also have a master's degree program that trains teachers into the early childhood. And so as they were looking at their offerings, they wanted to allow for those early childhood folks who are being trained to be that teacher, but also have the option of gaining some training in early childhood special education to expand their employability, plus, as we all know, early special education is a high-need area for our state. So this is the approach that they took, putting all of their resources that they had and experiences they had with the early childhood special education program, found the key components that they are comfortable with to move that into their bachelor's degree program as well, and then be able to offer a more robust program that was program. This was reviewed by here at the department, one of the questions that we came up with was really about the student teaching component and how they ensured that that individual got both the experience in early childhood and also the early childhood special education. And through conversations with the deputy, he explained that that was how they did their training, to make sure that individuals that were going for the minor, which is elective, they don't have to get left to college, but their placement would include both experiences in an early childhood setting. In addition, they would also be working with an early childhood special education specialist so that they would be both sides. So that dynamic, and also have an opportunity to see how those two worlds interact with each other. Behind the cover of this memo, you'll find all of the work that the institution had to do in order to move it through their processes internally, as well as gain approval from the their larger accreditation body, the Northwest Commission for Colleges and Universities. That's the essence of the proposal. They would like your approval of this so that this program could be on our approved list on our website and be recognized by other states as well as by policy by our state as well. Any questions?
Member Thompson, are they also looking for a retroactive approval of anyone who went through and got a minor?
Yes, they are. They had some graduates here recently. There's a letter from.
And I guess I'm questioning: do we have the authority to approve something retroactively? I don't know if that's a legal issue or not.
Thankfully, I'm not an attorney, so I'm going to answer that question.
Oh, if I might say, Rebecca had to go back to the office, and she'll be back for the regulation piece.
The board's attorney had to step out, and that's a question that we can note, and we'll turn back to her. That doesn't help you right this minute, but we'll get some feedback.
I could test her.
I guess that question has a similar question. I think as long as it's answered before we vote, I think that's important. I had a question as it related to, and I know this is a substantive change that is coming from UAA. My understanding, and you may not be able to answer this question, actually, maybe Member Hamilton or Member Hall can answer this question. But my understanding was the University of Alaska system was consolidating its education programs from UAF, UAA, UAS. And this looks like it's only an application from UAA. Is this something that is already being done at the other education programs or something that they're planning to do? And would it be easier to give a blanket approval when we do our motion, or do we have to give an approval as it relates to just the one organization, depending on what they do, that's requesting it at this point in time? So there's a couple, I guess there's three questions there. Thank you.
I'm Bob Williams, and Dr. Rich Stream, two lessons, and that, I believe those are plans, that change has not happened yet. So my understanding is that until that change has officially occurred, we still need to deal with these one at a time.
And I would just add, Member Harmon, that I have been in communication with President Johnson, and they're working through those changes, so there may be changes to those changes as they work through it. And so I think we, right now, just approve what they requested, and then move beyond that once they sort through how any transitions may or may not happen.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments? So it looks like the initial support of the board just got done over. Hopefully it was going over and then there was changes in the agenda.
Yes, there was some changes within the UA Dean's office. And so this kind of blocks the attention received so much earlier on.
Member Thompson again. I know the recommendation is to approve it, and I'm supportive of that if we have the ability to approve it. So I didn't want to make it look like my question was looking for a way not to approve it. I would just like to make sure that we have that authority, and I would support the recommendation.
Okay. Any other questions, comments? Okay, thank you. That didn't take as long as I thought it was going to, so we're at our lunch break, which is scheduled for 11:45, so we'll go ahead and take our break now and then come back at 1 o'clock to start back up. And I need to get the notice again, so if you're on the online starting at 1 today, the board meeting will be live streamed. The State of Alaska's WebEx webinar service. A live stream link can be found on the LIO's Live Now webpage at akl.tv and on the department's homepage in the State Board Meeting news release at education.alaska.gov. For members who wish to call in and listen, the toll free number is 1-855-244-8681. The meeting access code is 807-900-742, and we will be back at 1 o'clock. Thank you.
host is exiting the conference.
Oh, good. Thanks.